Alcoholic. And now I'd like to introduce our main speaker for this evening, Kylie L. from San Diego.
I'm Kylie. I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is October 3rd of 2004. Oh, man, there's a lot of people in here. Congratulations also. Thank you, Darren. And dig your shirt. We are not a glum lot. That's why I have Christopher walking in the front of my big book. And I brought my big book. It's like a safety. It's like my safety net for pretty much everything. I read it a lot, and this is my second big book. My first one fell apart. Due to, well, working the steps with others, really, again and again and again. And I used to bring my daughter to this meeting when she was a baby and feed her in the back row. She's grown up in rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I'm really grateful for that. And I guess I could talk. So happy Cinco de Mayo, or Cinco de Drinko, as my friend Darren likes to call it. I have a funny story about that too. I'm a real alcoholic. I'm guessing that a lot of you are too, because you wouldn't be here on Cinco de Mayo on a Saturday night. That's kind of an awkward place to be in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, and we don't get here because we're well, that's for sure. And if you're here and you're wondering why you're here, or if you've, you know, if you're a newcomer and you've never been here before, just stick around, you know, keep coming to these places and talking to the rest of us crazy people, and we'll help you out. It's we. That's what it is. Like, we all have to, like, stick together because none of us are completely well. So I like that, because I spent a lot of time alone, and I can still spend a lot of time alone. Anyhow, I think that I first time I ever drank, I blacked out. Well, I guess it's not the first time I drank. I had sips off my dad's beers when I was a kid. But when I first actually got drunk, I blacked out. I was 13 or 14, I think. And I knew instantly that I didn't drink like other people. I didn't really care to. And all my friends thought I was insane, and I didn't really care what they thought. And all I wanted to do was break into their parents' liquor cabinets, because their parents didn't drink what was in there anyways. And that became my main focus from that time on. And I used to drink and drive a lot. I go into blackouts, and then I like to drive. It's kind of like, I guess you could say it's kind of like Back to the Future and the DeLorean, because it's time travel, but it's really dangerous time travel. I don't know if any time travel is safe, but if you're in the car with me and I'm drinking, you're definitely not safe. And I think if one of your cars dies of alcohol or drug-related causes, you might be an alcoholic. But if you have several cars that die as a result of alcohol or drug-related causes, then you are definitely an alcoholic. That's me. I like to total cars when I'm drinking and driving. I do not know how I survived. I like to get my license taken away. Well, I don't like to get it taken away, but I got it taken away 3 times by the time I was 20. And I drove on suspended licenses that whole time. And I remember going to DUI class, and they would say, like, you can't show up 24 hours before loaded, and you can't go drink after you get out of here. And I was like, when the hell am I going to drink then? You know, this doesn't work for me, because it's not something that I can do. I can't just not drink. And I think probably around that age is when I started realizing that I lost the power of choice in drink. And in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, we talk about alcoholism. Starting in the doctor's opinion, we talk about all of the different symptoms of my alcoholism. You know, I have a mental obsession, and I think about drinking. I also think about not drinking. Normal people don't do that. Normal people don't say, okay, I'm just not going to drink until Friday. And when I get to Friday, I'm only going to have two, and then end up in a blackout and wonder what happened. Like, that's not normal, right? And I think that the problem with me is that my control issues are very apparent to me when I try to stop, because I have no control. Control is an illusion. And the instant that I try to stop, I'm just overtaken by this insatiable urge. And we talk about the phenomenon of craving, which I put a drink in my body and all of a sudden I need like 700 more drinks and I need your drink, and it's crazy. And then the other part of me that is a little bit different too than the normal drinker is that I have this spiritual malady that no matter where I come from, I could come from a loving family, a kind family, I could come from a really dysfunctional family, a broken family, it doesn't matter. I've talked to people in this program from all walks of life, and we can all come from different walks of life, and we can still be alcoholic because the effect that alcohol has on us once we take that drink. And if you don't know if you're an alcoholic tonight and you claim to be an alcoholic, you need to know what that really means, because I have a friend named Jack who speaks all over the place, and he's very serious about this, where if we're going to meetings with our friends and we're just hanging out, you know, especially I sponsor a lot of young people, and I was young when I came in, and I was 22 when I got sober. And so I used to hang out in that group of people, and there were a lot of people in there claiming to be alcoholic. You know, I'm Kylie, I'm an alcoholic. Okay, what does that mean? If I don't know that I cannot stop once I start, if I don't develop that phenomenon of craving, if I don't have those telltale signs of real alcoholism, then claiming to be an alcoholic is kind of rough, and I might spend a lot of time going out and trying it again and again and again. And I think that there's some really helpful tips in the big book that talk about, you know, if you're not sure if you're an alcoholic, go out there and try some controlled drinking. If you can't stay stopped for something like a year, then you might have a problem if you start drinking and it just takes off. For me, I would try to stay stopped for a couple days at a time, a week at a time. It was easy for me to get alcohol at a young age because I've always been savvy. Like, I always kind of knew who to hang out with, and we would always find friends that were in their 20s when we were teenagers, like 14 or 15. And my friend Colin's here, and what's up, Colin? We've known each other for like 20 years, and we used to drink together. And it's funny because that's exactly what we did. We just fell in with the in crowd. We used to hang out with like a lot of people that had all of the best of everything there was to offer, or the worst, I guess I should say, but it was a pretty intense time, and I don't know how we aren't dead, because it got real. And honestly, like, the whole point of, I can't diagnose you as an alcoholic, you have to diagnose yourself, and that's kind of rough sometimes too, because it might take you, you know, banging your head against the wall again and again and again. And some people have lower bottoms than others. I had hit probably 7 different bottoms maybe before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and wanted to be here, because I used to show up, but I was drunk, or I'd leave and go get drunk. I remember one time I showed up to a meeting. I think I was 21. No, I was 21, and it was the year before I quit drinking. And I showed up to a meeting at the Serenity Shop, and it was a men's meeting. And I was with my boyfriend at the time, who had two DUIs, and I had one. And so we hung out to go get our court card signed, and we show up at a meeting, and these men were so gracious that they let me stay. And I remember that very vividly, because I probably owe that meeting an amends, if it even exists anymore. But that is like the love of Alcoholics Anonymous. They know that I'm screwed up, but they accept you anyways. That's what we do here. And we don't shoot our wounded. And the greatest thing about those experiences was I remember relating even then. And then there was a bar that was right in back of the Serenity Shop at that time called the Hungry Stick. And so we'd go and we'd drink right after we get our court card signed. And like, I never considered any of that a relapse because I never honestly ever tried to, I never even read the steps at that time. And I remember somebody gave me a big book in a blackout once. And I woke up the next day with this big book in my room. And I thought, what is this? And I must have been really wasted yesterday, you know? And I threw it away. I really wish I hadn't because I'd still have it now. But I threw it away and I ended up in rehab like a couple weeks later. But anyway, I could tell you a million stories about my alcoholism to relate. I feel like you already kind of get the picture. I was a good kid. I come from the Midwest. My parents are from Kansas and Colorado. You can't get more rural than farmland in that part of the country. And my mom is a classic Al-Anon, and my dad is a classic alcoholic. I can't diagnose him, but I know that he's somewhere in the Napa Valley evading everything and drinking on a farm somewhere, building barns. I don't know. I haven't talked to him in a couple years. I call him still, and I never get an answer. And I know that's because he's avoiding me because he knows I've been sober for a while here, and he doesn't want to hear it, you know. So, which is fine because he doesn't have to change for me. And I learned that coming here. And so I was this kid, and I remember all my uncles were really nuts. They like guns a lot, and I go over to my grandfather's house, and he had a room of death, that's what I called it, in the basement, where it was just like taxidermy everywhere. And I remember being like 3 or 4 thinking, why are they killing these beautiful creatures? And I couldn't understand it. And to me, it just seemed barbaric, but they called it sport, and they also called drinking sport. And I remember there was a fridge in the basement with pop and a fridge with beers, and they drink Coors because we lived in Colorado, and I just remember that they were always allowed to drink this stuff, and my grandfather drank schnapps, and I think he drank like peach and peppermint schnapps, and I even thought that was gross back then, though, I don't know, but I drank a lot of it later on, and so I remember taking some sips off my dad's beers, you know, they thought it was cute, and I thought it tasted like crap, and but I was attracted to the allure of it. I was attracted to what it did, how it changed people, and I learned how to love the taste of it later on, too, or not even care what it was I was consuming, but my dad, I did not realize, had a drinking problem other than the fact that my home life was not the greatest. My mom spent a lot of time kind of dealing with him and what he was doing or if he was quitting his jobs or not. And he was just a general whiny loser who would come home and say, you know, my boss is mean to me, I'm going to quit. And my mom would really have to kind of pick up the pieces. And I watched her be the man of the house most of my life as a kid, and I didn't realize that that had something to do with substance abuse, too. I didn't realize that a lot of his poor choices and sickness revolved around alcoholism of the entire family line on that side, and I'm really grateful I had a good mom. She's sitting here tonight. I'm really grateful because she taught me some kind of moral compass. I remember I didn't grow up. My dad, if you tried to drag him into a church, it was like he was going to burn alive. So my mom, though, every Christmas, every holiday, she had us in church, and we'd be there. And I remember that. And my uncle, her brother, was part of the church, and it was always felt so loving, and I always felt safe around that part of my family. And I'm really grateful for that, because a lot of us come from places that are super broken on both sides, and we don't really know what's going on. And we have no compass at all of how to form relationships or form families or any of that. And we have to spend a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous with a lot of therapy and a lot of step work to get right. And I'm actually really grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous, because it's like a massive family where I can actually go to people who know how to do these things that maybe my parents didn't know how to teach me growing up. And they can show me how to do it differently this time. And I'm really grateful for that. But anyhow, I was a really good kid. I was very quiet. I had a lot of bad things happen to me when I was really little, and it caused me to develop severe OCD. I had phobias, and I played my favorite thing was music. I played the violin starting at like age 8, and I just continued on that through middle school, but it does not make you popular. And I had braces, and I was gawky, and I was really tall and skinny, and I had 2 friends who I still know, and they even thought I was strange, and they didn't understand. I didn't understand either. I needed a drink, basically, because my malady was myself, and it still is, honestly. And so when I was 13, that's when like people started inviting me over, and their parents started having these liquor cabinets, and I was stoked because finally I'd found the answer. And like everybody talks about here, the instant that I got drunk for the first time, I got really sick, and I ended up passed out on the floor of my friend's place, and I was in a sombrero's bathroom, passed out in a corner, and like one of the college guys that we were hanging out with, I think I was 14 at that particular time when I got nice and drunk for the first time. And I just remember being like slumped over his shoulder, and we went to a frat party, and I don't remember any of it, but I remember coming to, and I was puking, and I was sick as hell, and I just wanted to do it again, because I thought, well, if I do it again, and maybe this, and so I even remember having my friend buy me a 6-pack, because we were hanging out with this guy that was in his 20s, so that we could use him to buy alcohol for us, and I had him get me a 6-pack, and I remember going to a park down by our house, and I sat there and I was like, I'm going to drink this entire 6-pack so that I can learn how to drink. And I'm not going to get sick, because I got to build a tolerance. And I was 14. I don't know what I was thinking. I just already knew that that's something that I didn't want to feel sick again. I didn't want to go through what I had been through. And then in our readings, we always talk about, you know, switching from scotch to brandy. Well, I did that too, actually. That's kind of an old-timey thing that happened more in the 30s and 40s and 50s. But, like, I drank whatever you put in front of me. I remember meeting, one of my very first boyfriends over a bottle of scotch one night. And the only reason I went to his house is because they said, we're going to have scotch. And I said, well, what the hell is scotch? Because I was 17, and I didn't know what that was. But all I knew is that if I drank it, I looked cool. And so then I taught myself how to drink gin. And about like 7 Bombay Sapphire martinis, instant blackout, time travel yet again. Just pray that you wake up the next day and are alive and know where you're at. But who cares, really? And so it reminds me of the last Cinco de Mayo that I drank. And I was a promotions person for all the imports. I used to work for Dos Equis and Tecate and Boddington's and Stella Artois before craft beer got cool. And so I was training to be a distributor right when I turned 21. And my manager at the time was in his 50s, and I had a DUI. So I would just have him drive, because even if he'd been drinking, I'm the one with the DUI. It's just crazy, like delusional thinking. But it didn't really bother me that he was the one that was driving, because it's not my responsibility if something happens. And that's just the way that I thought about everything. But my job was to get you drunk and make you show me your boobs for Mardi Gras beads and random, you know, bottle openers and keychains. And it was awesome. I loved that job. And I got paid a lot to do it. And so, and of course, you know, I can't just be a promotions person working in the alcohol beverage industry. I have to be a distributor because then I get control of all of it. And then I get to take it all over San Diego County. And it was wondrous. And but the thing is, I couldn't stop blacking out. And, you know, and I'd make all this money, and then the next day I'd wake up and it's all gone because I get super altruistic when I'm wasted. And I just want to get you a shot, and you're cute, so let's just hang out, and we'll drink like $300 worth of booze in about 10 minutes. And so it wasn't a very lucrative position, but anyways, I did a lot of things. I had a lot of horrible stuff happen to me as a result of my drinking that I'm sure a lot of us have gone through. I just was talking about this outside. I end up using a lot of illicit substances when I'm drunk. And that always gets a little spooky too, because you introduce substances, any substance really, outside of alcohol. And all of a sudden, people get a little bit more sketchy. You end up in houses that where they're cooking meth behind you, and they spill things and fireballs go up your back, and you just think, what's happening? Because you're kind of out there in left field. And, you know, you come to us 3 days later, you don't know what's happening. And you think, I should really fall asleep because this is weird. It's gotten weird. But the thing that I always came back to was alcohol. And the thing that I could never quit was alcohol, to be perfectly honest. Like, I could put down a substance because it gets weird after a while. I don't want to put it down, but eventually I'm going to either die or pass out, and my body will force me to make a different decision. But alcohol was the thing. And what changed for me is I remember being probably about 20 and sitting, I always made friends with people that had really cool stuff, like people in their mid-40s that never had children, so they'd kind of adopt me like their own, and they'd give me copious amounts of booze and drugs, and they always had really nice houses because they never had kids, and I'd go over to their houses all the time, and it was awesome, and we would sit around, and I had a friend that had a whole, living in Rancho Bernardo, the suburban mecca of whatever, and it was this little haven for me, and I'd go over there, and we'd play. He had a whole game room and a whole bar in his garage, and it was wonderful. But I remember sitting there one night and looking across the room, and I didn't want to drink that night. I was trying not to drink that night. I thought, I'll just smoke some pot. I'll just do some coke. I'm not going to drink, though. I'm not going to drink. And that stuff's kind of boring if you're not drinking. And so I couldn't do it. I couldn't not drink. And I remember seeing a bottle of Captain Morgan, a handle of Captain Morgan across the way, and I just, it called to me. And I knew that I wasn't going to be able to say no to it. And that was really one of the turning points for me, because I had already been to Alcoholics Anonymous. I had already seen you guys. I had already been in front of a judge. I had already been handcuffed so many times in the back of cop cars. I had almost died twice from taking just whatever you had in your pocket and not knowing what it was called, and then mixing it with alcohol and other substances. I had woken up next to crash kits in the hospital. I had woken up with my mom the anxiety level of this poor woman, I'm surprised she didn't have a heart attack back then, and she just let me hit my bottom. She let me hit my bottom, and I'm so grateful, because when all my friends were going to rehab at 16 because their parents kept forcing them to go to rehab, I was hitting bottom at 22 like I should be, because that was my end. That was the time that I decided, okay, I really can't do this anymore. But none of those circumstances ever made me want to get sober. It was just a random night, my last night drunk, that I was driving drunk on the way home, and I was on a suspended license in my little Ford Ranger I used to have, and I had a spiritual awakening in the car that night, and I remember thinking, well, everything I've ever done has somehow related to my alcohol use, And why do I want to die so bad? I'm 22. What is my problem? And at that moment, I thought, okay, there's got to be a way out. And I remember saying the prayer, you know, God, if just whatever you want, I'm down. Let's do this, because I don't know what the hell I'm doing anymore. And I went home that night and I asked my mom if she would send me to rehab. And she came in my room the next morning with a number for a place in Dana Point. And I said, whoa, I must have been really drunk last night. And I was still drunk, but whatever. It had been a couple hours. And we talk about seconds and inches and small window of time when somebody is desperate enough to actually need and want the help. And you need to get people in that time. Because the instant that we get over that desperation, we think that we can do it again. And we think we're going to be okay this time. And maybe I was just a little bit emotional yesterday, last week, last year. I don't mind going to jail. It's not that bad. I know everybody there now. And when the cops know you and harass your mom because they like to blame your parents for how screwed up you are, it's hilarious because, I mean, come on. I was making all my own choices, but anyhow, that's when everything changed for me, and I didn't have any more good ideas, so I went to rehab. Now, I thought when you got to rehab, they were supposed to fix you because it's called rehab, rehabilitation. Okay, so that means, in my mind, that I should go there, and they kind of, you know, tighten my screws, and they teach me how to drink like a normal person, right? I think that's exactly what rehab meant to me when I was 22, and when I got there, they took me here. They took me Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought, wait a second, that's what this is about? That means I have to go there? Oh, man. I don't know if I want to go there, but I was willing. I was just willing, and I was tired, and I had already rode the wheels off. I didn't care anymore, and so I was willing to do something else. And I got here, and I listened, and I did whatever they told me to. I had like 5 commitments a week, and I didn't like any of them, and I bitched about it all the time, but I showed up anyways. And I got involved with a young people's group, not for very long because I needed more recovery around me than that. To be perfectly honest, I can get in a lot of trouble if I'm hanging out with a bunch of people my own age at that age. But I was really grateful for it because I learned about the traditions and the concepts within the first couple of months of my sobriety. And I worked all my steps by the time I had 3 months and I was sponsoring people at 6 months. And that's what started the whole journey. And for some reason, the holes started filling in. And I started feeling okay with myself. And I was still really anxious. I'm a very anxious person. I feel like I'm jet propelled on anxiety some days. But I have to do a lot of meditation and a lot of prayer to get to that, and I'll get to that in a second. But this spiritual malady I was talking about earlier, I mean, I can know I have a physical craving and I can know that I have an obsession of the mind, but the spiritual part is a rough one because a lot of people come in here really fearing the spiritual part. And it's so funny because we are, alcoholics are people that we run from, I'm going to speak for myself. I run from feeling anything. If I feel things, it's but I will literally kill myself with a substance before having to feel a feeling, which is insane. It's just insane if you really think about it. It's so sad because true human connection is all about feeling. I deal with the limbic system and I've worked around neuroscience and I know that every decision that we make in life comes from the way that we're wired emotionally. It even is tied into our basic primitive fight or flight response because we need to know when we can trust something and when we can't. But the problem with alcoholics is a lot of time we come from these backgrounds where we've put ourselves through immense amounts of trauma. So our fight or flight's all jacked. And so we come here and we have to iron out, and it's really hard. It takes a lot of time. And I think that is the real beauty of it, is just to be really loving and kind. I'm learning right now. So if I believe that I am an infinite spiritual being having a human experience, okay? So I am not defined by a bag of bones, because I feel things so deeply. I feel stuff for people, and I want to love everyone. Keith Miller always says, you don't have to like them, but you have to love them. And I use that a lot because I'm learning right now to have unconditional love. And the thing that's hard about that is it's very godlike. And I'm very connected to God now. You know, we go to step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. The first part of that, you don't have to get here and know what the hell is going on. But as you start experiencing the steps, as you start taking others through the work, the spiritual experience is amazing. It's like better than any drug I've ever taken. When I'm standing up here right now, I'm getting this crazy rush of dopamine, and, you know, I'm getting all this. It's just like love pouring out to all y'all, you know, because this is really where it's at. There is nothing better than being of service to another person, because it makes us feel like we're worthy, because we are. Every person is. It can do this work. You know, you don't have to have a degree to be an Alcoholics Anonymous. You don't have to know. You're not going to graduate. Please don't. I'll hunt you down and I'll be like, where you been? No, not really. Sometimes I'll do that if I really feel the need to, because sometimes I think that people need to know that we're still here and that we care and we love you, you know. Anyhow, so we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. Like, you can, after that spiritual awakening, we carry the message, because that's how we transmit depth and weight. But even if you have one day and somebody comes in and they are even a couple hours newer than you, and you've been sitting in a meeting, you can transmit something to them. It's this long chain of energy that just keeps going. There is nothing that I'm going to go back through the steps, actually. There's nothing that I can do here that hasn't been done before and won't be done after me. But I know that this is the only place that I've really learned who I am as a person and who God is for me, because it's my personal relationship with God. So I want to touch on this. What time do I have until? Okay, good. So, thank you. It's very accurate. So, one, we admitted we're powerless over alcohol, our lives have become unmanageable. I talked about that briefly, right? There's two parts to that. We're powerless over alcohol. Okay, I already know that I have that craving and that mental obsession. Do I know my life's unmanageable? Well, I did. But I know people that are functioning alcoholics, and they are really frustrating to me because they show up to work every day. I couldn't do that, okay? I have a hard time doing that now, but I do it. I do it. So came to believe a power grant in ourselves could restore us to sanity. So it's came to believe. It doesn't say we believe and I'm like sure of it right now. It doesn't work that way, because even if you come here from no God, a different concept of God, whatever, by the time you get here, you develop a whole new connection through just being close to us. We are so, God speaks to me through you all the time, and you'll hear it again and again and again. It's kind of cheesy. God speaks to me through you, but it's the truth, because I have had the craziest experiences of intuitive, like we talk about the promises and how our intuition, it just kind of turns on. We begin to trust ourselves. And I get these crazy messages sometimes. I'm like, what is this even really happening? And it is, because I just trust that this is some kind of connection to a power greater than myself. And I don't have to understand it. I just have to work with it when it comes. And I have to trust. And that's all that it requires, is just not knowing and understanding that you don't have to know right now. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to that power. So you don't even, the 12 and 12 talks about, if you don't have a particular God or a higher power in your life quite yet, you can trust that the group of drunks in Alcoholics Anonymous has some kind of idea of what's going on, and because there's people here that are staying sober and you're not. So if that's all that it takes to start your journey, then that's okay too. I think a lot of times just being humble and not knowing everything is pretty much the best place that you can be at. In my opinion, that's where I was when I got here. I had been here before, but I didn't know what the hell was going on, and I'm really glad I didn't, because now I can be teachable. And so, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I don't know why people get hung up on the step. Those feeling things come back again. That's what happens. And I'm just feeling things, and this is very difficult for me. I'm like, okay, that's fine. I was just talking to someone today. You know, courage is not about wanting or liking to do something. It's about taking the action regardless, okay? So I understand that it brings up stuff from our past. I understand that these things are very difficult for a lot of us to deal with if we've never had to deal with them before. But there's always somebody to trust in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's always somebody to go to read your inventory to. I've read inventory to friends before if my sponsor wasn't available. I mean, that's just the way that it goes. And so we are just willing to make that inventory process happen. And five is actually giving that away and reading it to somebody that you trust. And we go for an hour after those steps and we read 6 and 7 in the big book, and we're willing to acknowledge these character defects that we find, because we all have a part in a situation that we've been through. And the inventory process is where I learned how to acknowledge that I can't blame everybody else for my problems anymore, that I have to be willing to acknowledge that I have, oh, this is my favorite paragraph, actually. I'll just go to this. So on page 62, selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity, we step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find at some time in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later places us in a position to be hurt. So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making, even when we don't think that they are. Because I do things now. I was just doing a third step with a sponsee the other night, and I had like a weird experience where we read this part, and I thought, oh, I need to do an inventory. I have a resentment, and I need to do an inventory and read it to somebody, because I've been acting in a controlling way, and I've been playing the director, and then I'm selfish, self-centered, I'm afraid. All of whatever it's driven by fear. It's fear. That's why when I was talking about learning to love somebody unconditionally, as if God would, because I believe God loves me unconditionally, right? So if that's the way that God loves me, I want to love you that way. Well, that's scary, right? Because you might leave. I have fear of failure, fear of abandonment, fear, like so many lists of fears. We also do our fears inventory when we go through this process of 4 and 5. And it's very illuminating, because it tends to crop up again and again and again. And if you're like me, I tend to have the same fears, like the same two or three fears that come up with everything that's happening in my life. And the beauty about the inventory process and 6 and 7, when we're we humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings, we do the 7-step prayer in the big book, and we talk about being willing to have those removed. It doesn't say that God's going to be like, all right, cool, I took your selfishness, you're good now. It doesn't say that. It's just that we're willing to basically acknowledge them and to pray for God to give us strength to have this removed if that is his will, right? So made a list of all persons we'd harmed, became willing to make amends to them all. You just have to be willing to make the list. A lot of the resentments that I had towards people, I owed an amends to, okay? And then some people that weren't on my inventory, I also owed amends to. So I had to really get honest with myself about who those people were. And for me, you know, you start with family first because they're the ones that are the closest to you. So the biggest resentments for the longest period of time since birth develop from those. And I used to point the finger at my dad and say, you're the reason I'm an alcoholic. I used to call him drunk when I was 17 and say, it's your fault. All of this is your fault. But really, I had to come to grips even with that particular resentment. When I found out that he was just a guy that really was never built to have children. He was never a father. He didn't want to be. And that's okay. When I stopped expecting him to show up how I wanted him to, is when I got free. And when I made amends to him, and I told him, it wasn't your fault that I'm an alcoholic. I am just who I am. And that you did the best that you could. And loving him unconditionally regardless, I still don't like him. Don't get me wrong, but I do love him as a person, and I know that he has shortcomings I can't overcome and he can't overcome, and that's okay. And so from there, you start getting free slowly but surely. And then I go and I make amends to those people like I just talked about with my father. And I made, there were so many things that God did to put people in my life to make amends to when I didn't even think that they were even around anymore. I could tell you so many stories. I wish I had time to tell you a few, but I mean, really, the best thing that you can do is work them yourself and then see what I'm talking about, because I can tell you about my spiritual experience, but it's not yours. And so 10, continue to take personal inventory when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. This is something that I do every night. I sit and I read, you know, and I go through and I think, okay, how was my day today? Did I do this? You know, do I owe an amends? Do I have any more resentments? Do I need to call my sponsor about anything? Do I need to make a direct amends? I also do it if I talk to somebody and I'm not very nice. I instantly have to go back and say, hey, you know what? I've done this to people, like at restaurants and stuff. I'm sorry, I'm a little cranky today, but that doesn't excuse the fact that I treated you that way. It's not okay. There are some things that this program teaches us how to do on the spot that nobody would have ever taught us how to do that stuff. In fact, I work in an industry where all my patients come in and they point the finger at all of us saying, it's your fault, your fault. There's a lot of people in this natural world that do not know how to own anything that they do. And that's what's really frustrating for alcoholics, especially ones that work the program. We go out into the world and nobody's doing what we want them to do. Because we all think that they should be working the steps out of the big book, which they probably should. But I think the world would be a better place if that happened. But, you know, that's why all I can do is do what I can do for me to make your lives easier. Because trust me here makes everybody's life easier. So thought through prayer and meditation, both prayer and meditation. You know, our conscious contact with God as we understand this. So right now I'm in this pretty deep spiritual seeking, right? And I'm learning how to, everything that I've ever judged, I've done. And this is something that I'm realizing. And so when people call me for advice, I'm like, I don't know. I got nothing. I don't know anymore. And that's okay. And I'm seeking God in a whole new way. And it's really beautiful. And I'm learning so much more about what that is to me. And I'm learning how to be okay no matter what, because I get really anxious and I get really fearful. But if I just keep praying, and a lot of times my prayer is like, all right, let's do this. That's me going and leaving the house. Like, all right, God, let's do this. It's like we're friends, because that's how it has to be for me. Because when you disappear, I can't rely on you. Nothing can keep me sober that is human, right? So if I keep relying on humans to keep me sober, I'm going to be really discontent and I'm going to get resentful again. And so 10 is great for that, because then we work out the resentment again and again. But 11 is huge, prayer and meditation. We got to listen and we got to pray for God to, I pray for God to put me in the right place to help somebody else. I try to be as selfless as possible with my prayers, even though sometimes I'm a little selfish. Sometimes. But mostly every day I'm like, all right, your will, not mine, be done. What do you want? What do you want me to do? Where do you want me? And that's as good as it gets some days for me. Having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics. I'm carrying the message right now. I don't know if it holds any depth or weight for you, but it doesn't matter, because I'm sober right now, right? And I'm here on a Saturday night with you guys on Cinco freaking de Mayo. I just had one of those weird epiphanies where my mind is blown. Like, why? Whoa, we're here. This is weird. Maybe we're in a parallel universe. And to practice these principles in all our affairs, okay? So I'm going to continue to leave this place and do the best that I can to treat others with love and kindness, which I don't always do, but I also have tools to show me how to fix it if I screw it up, because I screw it up a lot. I screw it up a lot. But I'm telling you, the longer I've been here, the more that my expectations have gotten a lot less of everybody around me. And I've had to learn how to show up and be a better daughter, a better mother. I have a 5-year-old. Her dad died of this disease 4 years ago. A lot of you in this room knew him, and he was a brilliant and sweet, kind soul. But he could not get this. He relapsed for 6 years, and it was painful. We met each other in our 20s, you know, and we have a beautiful daughter. She's 5 now, and she's so stinking smart and sweet and kind, just like him, just like him. And I'm so grateful for her. But I hope that things like that happened with him, like, I hope he didn't die in vain, because I think that for a long time I asked why things like that happen, and I realized that it's to carry the message to you guys and to tell you that through that experience, I stayed sober. I held on for dear life at times. Just this last year, I've come out of grief, and it's like the whole world is bright again, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful I can still love. I'm grateful that I have a new lease on life, just like it talks about in the Big Book. I wish I had time to read more passages to you. I wish I had time to tell you more stories. But I'm so grateful I got to be here tonight. And I just hope that if you come here, that you stay. And that you get a sponsor and you work the steps, even if you don't know what you're doing. Because you don't need to know. You'll find out if you stay. Okay? Thank you. Yeah.